Money Radio, thank you for joining us. Pleasure to welcome Thomas Davenport. Thomas Davenport is a co-author of a new book, Keeping Up with the Quants, Your Guide to Understanding and Using Analytics. Co-author is Jin-Ho Kim. Thomas Davenport is a visiting professor at the Harvard Business School, President's Distinguished Professor of IT and Management at Babson College, and a research fellow at the MIT Center for Digital Business. He's also a senior advisor to Deloitte Analytics and co-founder and research director of the International Institute on Analytics. Your co-author is Jin-Ho Kim, a professor of business and statistics at the Korea National Defense University and the research director of the KNDU Lab for Analytics Research. Tom, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Keeping Up with the Quants, Your Guide to Understanding and Using Analytics. It's a rather daunting-sounding title, and if someone is not a quant or familiar with analytics, they may think that this is not for them. However, it is specifically for them, isn't it?
It is. It's for people who aren't quants, but who would like to know more about being a quant and working effectively with them and so on. It's not intended to make you a quant necessarily, but at least make you familiar with the subject matter.
Why does someone want to be familiar with the subject matter?
Well, because quantitative matters are sort of taking over modern life, you know, in almost every field from sports to entertainment to certainly almost every major business now is getting more analytical and quantitative in their thinking and their decision-making, and you don't want to be left out. I mean, it's becoming an essential tool in the modern business and management toolkit.
We hear about analytics and data as it applies to some places like Google or the NSA. There are really much broader uses, and it kind of pops up all over the place, doesn't it? Give us a few examples.
Well, virtually every large business today uses analytics for something. You know, maybe it's targeting the promotional offers that they send to you based on the things you bought in the past, or maybe it's figuring out exactly what is the best price to charge for their product that will yield them the most profit based on historical pricing patterns and, you know, at what different levels customers have bought. Maybe it's something even like directing, if you call into a call center, directing you to the person who's most likely to be able to successfully resolve problems like yours. Any website that's well-designed is going to have done a lot of quantitative testing to figure out which version of the website is more likely to get you to click on it. So it's just almost everywhere these days.
Some of the more intriguing little side areas that we might not think of, but we may have encountered, for example, Netflix uses algorithms to predict what movies you might like and make recommendations to you.
That's right, and they've been very successful at it, and I think it's had a big role in fueling their success. And even now beyond that, that now that they are streaming original television programs, shows like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, they took a lot of the risk out of making those programs by looking through their data, seeing what types of storylines, subjects, stars, and basically every aspect of the program to make sure that they would not be making, you know, spending the money on these programs in vain. The vast majority of network television programs historically do not last beyond a single season, but Netflix has been quite successful with it, and in fact, Amazon is doing something similar as well. They're also very data-oriented and also producing new video content themselves.
What movies, television shows, and I would imagine even books and music we are most likely to consume can be analyzed, and then I guess that goes into the decision of whether or not to to make that product?
Well, it should. historically speaking, the entertainment industry has not been terribly good at that. And only about 6% of Hollywood films make money, and about 90% of books don't sell. Books published in a year don't sell more than 100 copies or so. So that industry has been one of the laggards, but companies like Netflix and Amazon are starting to pull them into the 21st century as far as, you know, not creating so much content that people actually have no interest in.
And, of course, this goes beyond that to the basic idea of are the shelves in your store, in any given store, going to be stocked with the items that people are trying to buy?
Exactly. Shelf space optimization is something that retailers do a lot of, avoiding stockouts, you know, running out of the products that sell quite well and that they didn't really plan on. That's another area for analytics. In fact, in retail a few years ago, I don't talk about this in the book, but a few years ago I did a study on retail analytics, and there identified about 40 different areas of the store, from, you know, what kinds of people to hire to where to put the store in the first place and so on, that are driven at least potentially by analytics.
There are different types of analytics that, and you break them down as, let's see, descriptive, predictive, prescriptive analytics. Explain a little bit of the difference in what we're trying to achieve with these different types of analytics.
Sure. Well, the most common that people are familiar with in organizations, most common type, is descriptive analytics, and those are just reports on what has happened in some aspect of your business or organization. So how many visitors came to your website yesterday, how many dollars of revenue or profit did a company make last quarter. Those are all descriptive statistics. And I mean, it's useful to know those things, obviously, but the fact that they're only about the past is a bit of a problem. We'd rather know what's going to happen going forward, and they have another problem, which is they don't tell you anything about why they happen. There's no sense of what the underlying drivers or the dynamics are. So for that sort of thing, companies try to do what's called predictive analytics, which is basically done by creating a model describing events that have happened in the past. It's pretty hard to get data about the future, so we can only work with data from the past. But if you create a model that explains that data and, you know, what the underlying variables are that drive whatever outcome you're interested in, then you can turn it into a predictive model for the future. And companies do this all the time, you know, predicting how many of a particular item you're going to buy, knowing how many of them to, you know, ship to a particular store. They predict what's going to make you likely to click on a web banner ad, or, you know, Google does predictions about what makes you likely to click on an ad in a web search, even predictions about which site should be coming up first, which site are you most likely to be interested in at Google. They're a highly analytical company. And then the third type, predictive, prescriptive analytics, are analytics that sort of tell people at the front lines of an organization what to do. So maybe it's what price to charge. Maybe it's when to stop for fuel if you're a truck driver. Now companies like Schneider National have sensors in their fuel tanks, and that's connected to an operation center that tells them, you know, when you're likely to run out of fuel and what the closest truck stop is with a good price on diesel fuel. So prescriptive analytics can be very efficient, although, as you can imagine, the people at the front lines are sometimes not that thrilled about being told how best to do their jobs.
And that is a concern. Many people don't want to be told how to do their jobs. Sometimes I wonder if the results that I find on a Google search are so tailored to me that I'm missing out on something that didn't fall under those parameters. Part of the idea is behind a search is to find something unexpected.
Well, there is that issue. Some people have suggested that search engines ought to incorporate serendipity and, you know, throw something in that maybe you didn't expect. But most of us these days are so pressed for time that we are happy to have Google make a prediction about what we're most likely to be searching for. And, you know, you can, a lot of searches yield 10 or 20 screens full of sites. And if you're really motivated, you can go down to the 12th or the 15th or the 27th. But most of us don't have enough time to do that.
Next up is the question of why. So what? There's a ton of data out there, actually petabytes and more. And the big data idea is a bit overwhelming at time. There's all this data, but then it has to somehow or another answer the question of why. And I guess one of the key things there is framing the problem. What do we actually want to apply big data to, and what can we hope to achieve from it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we talk about the steps that you go through to do a quantitative analysis in the book without, you know, getting into a huge amount of detail. And the one that the ones that are most overlooked, I think, are the ones at the beginning and the end. The framing, which, as you suggest, is arguably the most important step. If you don't kind of set up the problem, the analysis, the decision that you're making in the right way, you know, no matter how good your data, your analysis is, you're not going to come to the right answer. Mm-hmm. So we give an example of a trial in California that yielded a bad outcome for some people who were not guilty at all, because the prosecuting attorney framed the problem the wrong way, and fortunately for the defendants, it was overturned by a higher court. But if you're not thinking about your hypothesis in the right way, if you're not looking at a variety of alternatives, you know, if you're not going through a good job of framing, you're not likely to make a very good decision, no matter what you do in the later steps.
Is it possible to be creative and merge creativity with analytics?
Yeah, we certainly argue that it is. And, you know, people talk about, I don't want to avoid intuition altogether, and I have all this experience. And that often comes into play when you're creating a hypothesis. You know, a hypothesis is basically an intuition about what's going on in the world. The difference between intuition and analytics is that you test that hypothesis with data. Why wouldn't we want to know if our understanding of the world is really accurate or not based on, you know, the data that we can gather? So I think there are plenty of places where intuition and creativity come into play with analytics. They're sort of unfairly maligned as all being, you know, coldly rational all the time.
As we continue our conversation, I'd like to take a look at the danger of not thinking analytically and what we need to do to work with the quants. There is a website, keepingupwiththequants.weebly.com. keepingupwiththequants.weebly.com, and the new book is Keeping Up with the Quants, Your Guide to Understanding and Using Analytics. Keeping Up with the Quants, co-authors Jin-Ho Kim and our guest today, Thomas Davenport. We will continue the conversation in just a moment. Money Radio, our guest today, Thomas Davenport. The new book is Keeping Up with the Quants, Keeping Up with the Quants, your guide to understanding and using analytics. Not written for quants, but for people who may have quants in their life in one form or another. The danger of not thinking analytically. You gave a great example of AIG, the insurance company, and their role in the 2007-2008 financial meltdown, and the case of Joe Cassano, who was involved in derivatives trading, something he really didn't understand. He took over from Tom Savage, who was a trained mathematician. What is that risk of not understanding quantitative analysis and having someone in there making mistakes? I mean, are we putting at risk the entire global financial system and perhaps much more?
Well, Joe Cassano did anyway. He was called, I think, by Rolling Stone magazine, patient zero of the global economic meltdown. He lost more than $85 billion, or his small group at AIG lost that much, which, of course, the U.S. Government decided to step in and take care of. Now, the good news, I guess, is that AIG has pretty much paid the U.S. back. But when you have a manager like Joe Cassano who, you know, he sort of the only numbers he really understood were that selling these credit default swaps were very profitable. He didn't take the time to understand what the underlying algorithms are to create them, what the assumptions behind them are. You know, there are always assumptions behind analytics, Sinclair. And if you don't understand what those underlying assumptions are, you can get into huge trouble, as they did at AIG. So, obviously most of the time we're not going to bring down the global economic system by our failure to think and act analytically, but we will certainly make worse decisions as a result. I mean, there's a lot of evidence in every sphere of human endeavor suggesting that analytical decisions tend to be more accurate than ones that we make on the basis of our intuition. And in fact, you know, as we learn more and more about the kinds of intuitive decisions we make, particularly about money, by the way, this whole field of behavioral economics, we find we're just not very rational about it.
So if non-quants pose a risk, does this mean that quants are eventually going to rule the world?
Well, yeah, one could argue that they're already moving in that direction. You have a huge demand for quantitatively trained people coming out of the growing number of college and university programs that educate them. You have companies like Google and eBay and Amazon that are highly, highly analytical, that have grown very rapidly, you know, have incredibly valuable equity. You have older companies like Capital One that were really founded with the idea of analytics as the core of their business. They call it information-based strategy, and Capital One returned more value to shareholders in its first 10 years than any other company in the history of the United States. So, I don't know if they're going to totally rule the world, but they're certainly going to be a lot more influential in the world's decisions.
Certainly would make sense that you need to understand at least how to work with the quants, how to keep up with the quants, and there's a book that can be your guide. It's Keeping Up with the Quants, Your Guide to Understanding and Using Analytics. Keeping Up with the Quants. And it sounds a bit daunting, the title, but the book is really very well written. You can follow along even if you are not a quant, and you are going to learn something. There are some eye-opening ideas in this book. Keeping Up with the Quants, co-authors Jin Ho Kim and our guest today, Thomas Davenport. Thank you so much.
Thank you.